You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT. Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. You're here with Kevin. Anne, how are you, Anne?
Kev, I'm good. A bit sleepy today in these winter moments.
Yeah, it gets like that, doesn't it? The weather gets cold and you just feel like, you know, hibernating. It's
It's nice to be in the studio together, just the two of us.
It is. It is, actually. We've done this very little so far this year. We've had other people in, or I've been in, or you've been in, or whatever. So, yeah, no, it's nice.
You know what I've been doing lately?
No. What have you been up to?
It's completely the wrong time of year.
Yeah.
But I've got all excited about outdoor plants.
Because
my apartment lifestyle, I just have indoor plants.
Yeah.
And so now I've been planting a few plants. You're allowed to do it at this time of year.
I've seen. You've constructed a little something in your minuscule courtyard. You're turning it into a little nature reserve, and that's lovely.
That's right. And speaking of nature reserves, I figure I'm doing my job, my bit for climate change, because I was listening to this podcast the other day, the regenerative podcast, the regeneration podcast, which I really like. And there was this woman, Dr. Katie Ross, who was speaking to the Australian Water Association conference. And she was explaining how it's not just the carbon cycle we have to worry about. It's also the water cycle.
Right.
And planting more plants helps the water cycle in all these really interesting ways. Like, it cools down the planet because plants create clouds that are lower down.
Oh.
And the lower down clouds have a cooling effect, whereas the clouds that are way up high, they have the warming effect.
Right, okay. Ah, okay. That makes sense, yeah.
So I figure I'm doing my bit.
Well, it's working because it's been cooler recently, Anne.
Well, you know, we always bang on about the resources here. It's not the money. The money we know we're never going to run out of, but it's all about the resources.
Talking about resources, well, kind of, sort of, everything is linked. This week we're going to explore and review the federal budget from a little while ago. Isn't it amazing how the budgets sort of, they come and go and there's a bit of flurry of activity and then everybody forgets all about them.
That's right.
And what I find is that if you're too quick off the mark, if you don't let the dust settle, it's hard to get a good overall picture of what the budget means. And so I'm kind of glad that we've got a bit of time, because I've been doing a bit of reading and finding some reactions and trying to figure out how things fall. And
it's been interesting watching the discussion around the budget. I think that's always the most interesting part. Less so the actual budget, because I never have high expectations, and you can tell me if I'm wrong about this one. But the narrative around the budget's always really interesting.
I'm sort of interested to see how the mainstream media, in particular, how much effort they put into attacking some of the measures in the budget, because it's interesting. There's good and bad about this budget.
Shall
we hook into it?
Yeah, let's go into it.
Rightio. The first thing, and the main headline on this one is the reversal of the 50% capital gains tax and the winding back of negative gearing. Okay, so I was interested to find some history behind this, because you sort of think, rightio, well, what's going on here? So in 1999, we had the introduction of the 50% capital gains tax discount. It was the Howard government, so it had Howard and Costello in power, and they were following a recommendation in the 1999 business tax report for the Howard government by mining businessman John Ralph, which argued that the change would create a nation of shareholders and encourage investors to buy and sell assets more frequently. So you got a guy, this guy, John Ralph, who is trying to get Australians to invest in, you know, mining, I guess, but all sorts of other things. And so he was keen to get people involved in shares and investing in Australian activity. And a lot of people did, but around that time, there was a bit of a thing called the dot-com bubble. So the dot-com bubble was an historic stock market cycle from 1995 to 2000, driven by the rapid growth of the internet. It was fueled by easy venture capital and get-rich-quick hype. Investors poured money into untested web startups that had high website traffic but no viable business plans or profits. So it was kind of like there was and I think I actually got caught up in a bit this
you
myself.
You only had to call yourself a dot-com and people would start investing in you.
Yeah, yeah. So it peaked. The bubble peaked on March the 10th, 2000, when the technology-heavy NASDAQ composite index surpassed 5,000. Then the bubble burst when the Federal Reserve raised interest rates. Venture funding dried up and investors began to focus on the reality of massive cash burns and missing revenue. From its peak, the NASDAQ plummeted by roughly $5 trillion in market value and lost nearly 78% of its value by October 2002. Countless companies went bankrupt, leading to mass layoffs in the tech sector. So essentially what you had was right at a time when the Howard government was trying to encourage people to invest in the stock market, there was this massive stock market crash, and that scared the bejeebus out of everybody. So as a consequence of the stock market volatility, many investors shifted from stock market to property just a few years after Howard and Costello introduced these reforms. This failed to create a nation of shareholders and encourage investors to buy and sell assets more frequently, and instead created inflating property market, which made existing property owners feel artificially wealthy. The property market has been inflating. That's 1999 to now. There's like a 400% increase in property values, and for instance, wages are about half that value. So we hear about inflation the whole time, but of course, housing isn't included in the inflation figures,
right?
Which is kind of interesting. That might have been taken out by Keating, I think.
Wonder what the number would be if it was.
Yeah, but the thing is, when people's houses prices increase, they feel good. You know, now I was actually in the property market back in those days. I bought a place in 1992, cheap. That was at the bottom of the market, and I remember, you know, later on during the late 90s and the early 2000s, just watching the value of the house that we're in, which is just an ordinary house, just going up and up, and it makes you feel good. It makes you think, "Whoa, okay, this is good."
Riding the wave.
It's a bit like a drug. You sort of it's a really good feeling. So
it's a good feeling to be a rentier, is it?
Not a rentier. This wasn't a property investment. No,
it's rentier income. If you're not actually using your labour to create income, and it's simply a capital gain, which is what you're talking about, that's a form of rentier income, as is investing in the stock market.
Yeah, but we weren't driving an income. We were in a house, and it was increasing in value, and we sort of thinking, gee, we've made a good decision buying this house because we bought it for sweet bugger all, and now it's just going up and up and up, and it gives you this kind of false...
Yeah, it gives you validation for your decisions, I guess.
Yeah. But it's a false thought, because like our place might be increasing, but then so is everybody else's, and so the transfer value, if we sold the house we're in and bought somewhere else, all you're going to be doing is buying and selling in the same market.
Yes.
But nevertheless, I understand the feeling of I don't know, being secure, of having made a good decision when something that you've invested in just goes up and up in price. It's very alluring. It's very comforting, you know.
Yes.
And that's kind of like the drug that that homeowners have been on for quite some time.
Okay.
But of course, there's more to it than that, because essentially the Howard government was introducing policies for passive earners, for people to invest their money as opposed to working for their money. Because it kind of like the whole reason that they did it was to invest in the stock market, and then it's flipped over to housing. This scheme should have been scrapped in the early 2000s. Like when the dot-com bubble burst and everybody exited the stock market and started pouring their money into property and property prices are going up. It should have been nipped in the bud. They should have gone, rightio, this is heading in the wrong direction.
Was anyone speaking like that back then, I wonder?
No. Nah, no, everybody's feeling pretty good about it. You know?
That's the thing with bubbles, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. The 50% capital gains discount meant that when you sold your property, and this is not your home property, the property that you own is exempt from all of this. Mm. So, but it did mean that if you had
exempt from the capital gain, so you don't get taxed.
Yeah. Yep. So these measures that we're talking about only applied to investment properties. Right. So people would rip their money out of shares because it's all gone dicey, and they're going, mm-hmm. rightio, let's get an investment property instead.
Right.
Because the rules applied to the investment property as well, and so it was a good way of not attracting tax because 50% of the capital gain was going to be exempt from taxation mm-hmm. when you sold the place. Mm-hmm. And as well as that, there was also negative gearing. So negative gearing, I'll explain to the listeners because sometimes it's good to refresh.
Yes.
Remembering that. So negative gearing has been a part of the Australian tax system since 1936. And it was originally introduced to encourage private investment in housing and increase supply. While it has been a long-standing feature, the policy has undergone a few major legislative shifts. In 1985, the Hawke government quarantined negative gearing, meaning property losses could no longer be used to offset wage and salary income. But they reversed that 2 years later on. It wasn't very popular. So,
okay.
So in 1987, the government reversed this decision in response to a tight rental market and housing shortages, fully reinstating the original negative gearing rules. So what's happening here is you might be an income earner that's earning quite good money and you're hitting up the tax scale. You're paying a bit of tax. You buy a property. You're renting it out. The interest payments are more than what you're receiving in rent. Mm-hmm. You're taking a loss on the property, but you're happy to do this because you can use that loss against your other income, mm-hmm. even though it's a completely separate entity. It's a separate business. You know, mm-hmm. you might be, I don't know, let's say you're some sort of managerial position. You're earning good money. It's got nothing to do with your investment property, but you can use the loss from one against the other, even mm. though it's unrelated. Mm. On top of that, you've got the capital gain, which you're going to expect because the property market's going up and up and up.
It's the combination of the two, wasn't it?
So yeah.
Negative gearing was sitting there like a ticking time bomb and yeah. it went off when the capital gains was changed.
Yeah, so I'm guessing that the negative gearing was probably already there before 1999. I haven't checked yeah. this, but so you've got two good reasons, two reasons to make it safe to invest in property.
Yes.
While at the same time, the stock market's still a bit scary, and so a lot of people did. They they well, shifted.
One thing I've heard, and this is just off the top of my head, so don't quote me, which is that when you invest in property, you don't really tend to make a whole lot just from the rent. I mean, you're lucky if you're making 2% or so. Because of all the maintenance that usually cancels that out. So that's why people often are making a loss on their rentals because, you know, the fan breaks, the stove breaks, the heating breaks, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So they're lucky to make, you know, more than you would in the stock market. So when you pair that with the capital gains, suddenly you've got a reason to own a physical a house or whatever,
yeah.
because at the end of this loss-making exercise, you're actually going to make a lot of money.
And the other thing is that sometimes negative gearing turns into positive gearing. So you'll buy a house, rent it out, you'll buy a property and rent it out. And when you've bought it, the rent as a percentage of the purchase price might be quite small. But over time, the rent will go up. So you'll increase your rent and that increases as a proportion of the purchase price of the property. So as the value of the property is rising, your rental return is also rising. So it might actually be that eventually over time, 5-10 years down the track of owning this property, you're actually positively geared, and people think that's a bad thing. If you're making money, you're making money, so that's not a bad thing. So you know, at that stage of the cycle of the property that you own, it's going to have increased in value. It's now bringing you an income. You are going to have to pay tax on that, but you had all the negative gearing benefits from before you got to that stage. It's just a good proposition, you know. The degree of how many investment properties a person should have is an often talked about subject. And I don't really have too much issue with somebody who has one investment property, regardless of what their position is. I think it compounds when you have more and more and more. Anyway, there's no numbers put on this. Investment properties are regarded as an investment, just like investing in the stock market, etc. So they've been caught up in this. So the Albanese government proposed in the current budget to limit negative gearing for residential property investments only to new builds. So they're going to reverse something which has been around for a long time. And that's going to upset a lot of people because they're kind of used to it. But there are grandfathering of these measures. So
people who already have an investment, it won't change for them.
No, I'm pretty sure. Hang on, I've got to check my notes because there's a bit of information here, and I don't want to get anything wrong. Mm. Okay, so key details of the proposal: new builds versus established. From July 1st, 2027, investors will no longer be able to deduct net rental losses from established properties against their wage or business income. These losses will be quarantined to only offset residential rental income or capital gains. But this will be grandfathered. Okay, so grandfathering: properties acquired before the budget announcement on May the 12th, 2026, are exempt and will keep existing negative gearing arrangements, which is kind of fair because if you've made an investment and that investment was made on the tax implications of negative gearing, to have that suddenly change would be fairly brutal. I can see some arguments for it. I can see some arguments against it. But if you're going to introduce these changes, you want it to be a soft transition, not a harsh transition. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to the politics of this later on, but I can understand why the government has been cautious about this, because if it caused large disruption, it would be politically a very politically dangerous thing to do. You're talking about a measure that's been around for a long time, and especially the Albanese government, who are cautious and incremental, they're not going to rip into any huge changes, although this is a substantial change. Okay, so we're going to have a look at the effect that this has on housing supply. Okay, so since these measures are proposed reforms in the federal budget, they are not yet law and they must pass through Parliament. Banks and lending institutions are already adjusting customer borrowing capacities in anticipation of the changes. So let's have a look and see what's happened to the housing supply because of these measures. So in 1999, owner-occupied properties were 70% of the property market, and in 2026, it's 67%. So it's a 3% decline, which doesn't sound like much.
No, it doesn't. No, I'm surprised.
But it is a decline. Okay, so there are less people who are owner-occupiers now than they were before. If we break this into age brackets, if we talk about people in their early 30s, in 1999, 65% of people in their early 30s were in owner-occupied properties. In 2026, that's declined to 50%.
Oh, that's a bigger difference.
So we're talking that I've got that as a 23% decline. That's like a quarter of it's dropped a lot. So younger people are obviously finding it harder to get into the market.
That's why they say this is a generational impact.
Yeah. Public housing: in 1999, there was 6 to 7% of properties of people living in properties were in public housing. That's now down to 3%. So public housing has halved in that time, and that's
another.
That's
part
something
of the
which
squeeze.
Nobody is talking about,
except 3CR.
Yeah,
quite often.
Yeah, and so rentals in 1999 were 23%, and in 2026 they're 30%. That's a 30% increase in people in rentals over that time. So what we're seeing is a shift where there's less people in owning their own houses. That's particularly hitting the younger age group, and there's a corresponding increase in people renting at the same time, and that's got to do with these measures and also the decrease of public housing. So it's and if we talk about how much it costs, in the 1980s, a house was about 3 times your income, and currently it's up to 10 times your income.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, isn't it? Why it's unaffordable.
Yeah. So these measures.
You going to give us your professional opinion?
Well, I've got all these notes here. I'm tempted to read my notes, or I'm tempted to go off the top of my head. Okay, so it says here house prices are projected to increase by around 2%, which is not much.
That's what I heard too, yeah.
But they will stop inflating like they have since 1999, which is twice as much as wages, etc. Prices will flatten out, meaning ordinary income earners will be able to afford houses in the future. So as this acceleration of this constant inflation of house prices flattens out, then wages will increase over time. Just, you know, the 2 to 3% inflation, normal inflation, will make the difference between being able to afford a house and not become closer and closer over time.
Okay.
So there won't be any dramatic change right now, but you'll notice over the next 5 or 10 years that we'll be getting back to how things were before these measures were introduced.
That is such a political difficulty, isn't it? Because the way it went sort of downhill, if you want to say that, did happen over time. It happened over many years and it wasn't a sudden, abrupt change. And so you can't sort of turn this ship around abruptly either.
Well, especially if you consider the Labor government, there are lots of forces who can mobilise their vast resources and start a campaign against a Labor government at the drop of a hat. You see the mining industry, Gina Rinehart, some of these people. If they really want to make life hard for you, they can jump on board. So they'll be assessing the popularity of these measures. Mm. And if they reckon that they can wedge Labor on this, they'll be going hard. But I'll be interested to see how this plays out. They might just let it ride. They said they're going to reverse these policies if they get in. You know, they're in such a degraded state, the coalition. You know, they're trying to win back those on the hard right. They're ignoring the Teals. They're wedged and they've got to be careful. So I don't know. Anyway, so it's projected that there'll be an increase of 75,000 new first home buyers. That's an increase of 75,000 new home buyers with these changes over the next 10 years. This is expected to reverse the decline in owner-occupied houses, especially in the early 30s age group. This will lessen the demand for rentals as tenants will be purchasing the houses and apartments they would otherwise be renting. And this is something else which you hear is all of these people that own the investment properties are saying, oh, you know, we need to increase rental stock. There's a demand for rental. There's a demand for rental because the people that are renting can't afford to buy places because of the tax advantages that you've got. And they're always using this thing, oh, we need to look after the renters. You're causing them to be renters. Like this is the point. And they sort of forget to mention that. They just sort of say, oh, you know, we're doing this out of the goodness of our hearts. It's better for the rental. You just go, nah, piss off, buddy. Yeah.
Yeah. So even though it's not necessarily a policy that will create new builds, it's changing the ownership of the existing builds.
Yeah, it's going to make it easier for first home buyers to get into the market. It's going to stop the rampant inflation of house prices, because these investors are going to roll up to an auction with less benefits now, and they're going to go, and they should start thinking, you know, maybe we're better off investing in the stock market and getting out of the housing market, go back to where they were supposed to in the first place. Although, they
just end up inflating the stock market then. Yeah. But anyway,
it used to be that house prices were flat, and if you wanted to make money, you went to the stock market, and then that flipped. Mm. So this is a step towards flipping it back again. But there's not going to be huge shift in house prices, etc.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the attack on this, as we were saying before, it's often the narrative that's really interesting. And I heard a lot of this negative gearing changes to capital gains being framed as the Labor government breaking its promises. And what I've in the world, in the little bubble that I'm in mostly progressive and mainstream media, what I was noticing the commentators saying is that noticing a real sense of hope. Like, people were actually hopeful that finally Labor was taking its mandate into its hands to undertake reforms in the name of the working class. So that even though it's not a huge, you know, major shift, it was actually, you know, a lot of people were just getting really inspired by it.
It's a brave thing for them to do, you know. Like, they've been talking about this at least from 2016. Bill Shorten took it to that election. He then took it to the 2019 election. Mm. And he got smashed for it, you know, because the response from a lot of the boomers who were the investors at that stage was that, you know, you're attacking our asset, and they were larger in number than the millennials and the Gen Zs who are now growing in numbers. Well, that dynamic has flipped. So now there's more millennials and Gen Zs, and these are people being locked out. But the boomers themselves have changed their opinion a fair amount as well, because a lot of these millennials and Gen Zs are their kids.
Right.
And they're getting older and they're going, hang on, our kids can't afford to get in the market. So they're hitting the bank of mum and dad.
I want my spare room. room.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know. So they might just feel that, look, they can feel the difficulties that they're going through because they're their kids and they don't want to see them being, you know, burdened like this. But B, they're being hit up. They're saying, look, the only way our kids can afford a property is by us tossing bucks their way. So
despite what you read, it might end up being quite a popular policy.
There's been a shift in attitude from the boomers, and then the numbers of the people who are going to benefit from this have increased. Mm. However, this doesn't really alter the response from those enjoying passive incomes. and we heard Pauline Hanson refer to these measures as communism.
She's always good for a laugh.
She's complaining that there's a redistribution of wealth.
They hate that word redistribution, don't they?
You
can easily upset a right winger by talking about redistribution, and it is redistributing wealth, and that's how it should be because we've got this terribly unequal process going on.
Yeah, you know, and I find it very amusing that that Pauline Hanson, you know, the so-called voice of the working people, the ex-fish and chip shop owner, who is backed by Gina Reinhart, is coming out with this...
Jetting around in her new aeroplane.
A new $2 million plane and the rest of it. It is such hypocrisy. It is such fraudulent.
But it is. I mean, we've got to be honest. It is shifting wealth from the baby boomers back to the younger wage earners, as we should be doing.
Yeah. Well, it's just letting other people into the market, you know. So, I got no time for that. She's appalling. I've got more to say on this later. Do you reckon we should play a bit of a song, maybe, and have a bit of a digestion of this? Come back to some of the response.
What have you got for us today?
Well, I have a song called "Real Estate Mastermind," which I thought might be appropriate for the show. So, this is a song by Phil and the Tiles called "Real Estate Mastermind."
Happy 2023! If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
What's that up there on the airwaves? Is it 3AK? Is it the ABC? No, it's 3CR. Faster than Schildberger. More relevant than Mike Willacy. Able to get more writs than Darren Hinch. Yes, 3CR. With music and interviews totally off the planet. With powers and abilities far greater than commercial radio. And who, disguised as a mild-mannered community radio station, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the non-commercial way.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
You are indeed on Radio MMT with Anne and Kev, we're discussing the budget this time. But before that, before the break, we heard from Phil and the Tiles with a song called "Real Estate Mastermind."
Very appropriate.
My boy Riley's a guitarist in that band.
Ooh.
It was his birthday last week. Happy birthday, Riley! Fortunately, the band has split up, so you won't be able to see Phil and the Tiles around the place because they are no more. Internal artistic differences, I believe. How unusual.
Well, that was an historic moment then.
Yeah, that was a good song. They brought that in 2023. Reefy's the front guy for that. Hello, Reefy. None of these guys listen to my show.
You're the dad.
I'm the dad. No. Okay, so I'm going to sum up. There's a heap more other stuff. I was going to go into the response from the right-wing media about all of these changes to rentier income. They seem as if these privileges are theirs. Excuse me.
Entitlement. Yes,
yeah, entitlements are theirs, and they hate seeing their entitlements reversed. So it's a brave move by the Albanese government to do this, especially seeing as Albanese is so timid and so reluctant to do anything. So, but we should applaud them because I'm going to read what I've said about this. This is a brave move for a shell-shocked and very cautious Albanese Labor government. A lot of this government were around during the Rudd-Gillard years when they just got smashed from, climate change and the right just hitting them. So whenever they do anything like this, there's usually a big response, but this is a long overdue reversal of a Howard era neoliberal policy. It represents a fundamental shift in government policy away from neoliberal backing for capital and towards ordinary working people. It may seem like a small step, but it's a significant change in direction and should be applauded. This sort of thing has blown up in their faces before. The Conservative machine is very well funded and very well organised.
Albo is a Robin Hood on tax hike, Kevin. Yeah. As the mainstream media will tell you, I'm reading it word for word.
I picked up a copy of the Herald Sun the other day and we just had a look at some of the stuff.
Housing nightmare. Massive migration is hurting young Aussies. It's the migrants.
Yeah. So these exploding house prices have got nothing to do with all of the tax benefits. It's all the migrants' fault. They're coming in and crowding us all out. I mean, like there is an enormous amount of empty property around the place that could be accommodating people, except that it's being just banked by people because they're going to make money out of it eventually because of these tax measures. So it will relieve a lot of this stuff. There will be a shift. It'll be interesting to see. And if we've got time at the end of the show, I'll spend a bit more about that. However, I wanted to speak about the other side of the budget, and this is not so good.
Da, 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 da.
The NDIS.
Oh, okay. Tell us about it.
So the NDIS. I'm going to chuck some figures at you. Okay, so today that there are more than 760,000 people on the NDIS. This is estimated to grow by another 140,000 to about 900,000 by 2030. Mm. The government wants to reduce the number of people on the scheme to around 600,000 by that time. So that means reducing current participants by 160,000 while denying access to another 140,000. That's a total of 300,000 people who will miss out, or one in three who would otherwise be eligible. This is a big... These are big numbers. Mm. So what they're doing here is, you know, they're trying to make the scheme fit the budget. And they want to, and this is all driven by this balancing the budget kind of rhetoric and nonsense that we see from the neoliberal side of running the economy. And it's all about, you know, you can't run debt and deficit and this sort of thing. We've talked about this a lot on this show. It's nonsense. They can, but anyway, that's what's guiding it. So either the number of participants of 900,000 is wrong, or 300,000 people will miss out on support they need. These are big numbers. Mm. So the Australian government is implementing sweeping changes to the National Disability Insurance Scheme to reduce its growth rate. The government's aim is to reduce the growth of the NDIS by 2% per year until 2030. These budget reforms aim to save nearly $38 billion by 2030, and the most significant changes are cuts affecting participants. They've been talking about stopping the rorting, et cetera, but they're winding the scheme back.
And the rorting, I don't understand their logic on this. The rorting, supposedly if there's rorting, it's on the side of the people who are making the diagnoses. It's not on the side of the people receiving.
Well, yeah, they're talking about the rorting, and there certainly has been rorting. I mean, remember the NDIS was brought in at the tail end of the Rudd-Gillard government in 2013. Mm. So they brought it in and then promptly handed over to the coalition. Now, the coalition will destroy any... scheme like this, any sort of welfare scheme. They hate government intervention and handouts. They think everything should be run by the private sector, so they privatised the operators. There was no regulation. There was money going everywhere. Mm-hmm. So they do what they do, which is to just let a program like this run riot and then collapse from within. Mm-hmm. It's like they sabotage it from the inside and say, see, it was a terrible scheme, you know, by not regulating it. So there was plenty of rorting going on, but the government cuts that the Albanese government are making to this go way beyond that. So they want to reduce the costs of social and community participation. So the government plans to reduce the average plan from 31,000 back to the 2023 average of 26,000. So they're talking about an average cut of 5,000 or 6,000 per client per year. One of the main ways it will do this is to cut funding in plans for individual social and community participation. This funding is for supports outside the home and helps people to engage in their community and build their confidence. It can include things such as group cooking classes, fitness activities, social outings, or skills development. And I've seen this because there's a lot of musos that I work with who, in between gigs, are NDIS workers. My brother was an NDIS worker. I've got a good friend, Libby's an NDIS worker. And they just go out and do things. My brother, for instance, Jim, he's up in Queensland. He took this guy out and he basically wanted to go busking. This guy wanted to be out and playing music, and Jim's a musician, so they just go out busking, you know, and it was fantastic. It's
it's a lovely image.
Yeah, you know, and these seem like, trivial sorts of things. They're really inclusive. They make people feel like they're part of the community. Yeah. Otherwise, they're just sitting there isolated. So it's important. But they're aiming to cut these programs. Mm. So Butler announced the social and community participation component of the budget will be reduced by 30% and acknowledged that these cuts will have a material impact on participants. Instead, the government will allocate $200 million to a new inclusive communities fund. This will be available to mainstream and disability organisations to build up new options for people with disability to participate in their local community. We're talking about a $200 million band-aid after $38 billion of cuts. Ooh. It's way out of proportion. In reality, this funding replaces a fraction of what will be cut from participant plans. It also represents a reallocation of funding away from people with disability and towards organisations that will decide which services are offered. This change is inconsistent with the scheme's philosophy of personalisation and participant choice. Mm. So it's
It's just wrong. The timing of these changes is likely to present challenges. Reducing individual funding for social and community participation before the Inclusive Communities Fund has been able to develop alternatives leaves an obvious gap. So while they're making up these alternative arrangements, they're going to be cut off. There's going to be a scheme which is underfunded, which is supposed to replace it. In the meantime, there'll be nothing, which means they go back to nothing. So, you know, this gap requires urgent attention.
Mental health is so easy to pick on.
Yeah, you know, and this is, we're going to do some comparisons after a couple of other things. The second thing is there's new legislation around the functional capacity test. So new legislation introduces a functional capacity test, shifting eligibility away from an automatic access list towards strictly defined assessment of how much support an individual requires to function independently. Mm-hmm. So the government wants to move away from using medical diagnosis to determine entry and instead focus on functional capacity. In other words, eligibility will be based on the impacts a person's impairment might have on their life in combination with their environment and aspirations. So what we're saying here is that currently if you get a diagnosis from a doctor, you're eligible for the NDIS. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to say, well, no, we're going to see whether your disability really impacts on the way you operate. Mm. Now, how do you do that? That's going to require a more...
It's a lot of bureaucracy.
Yeah. So you can see they're going to try and shift numbers. They're going to increase the costs that go towards the bureaucracy to assess somebody's functionality in the community. It just, while it kind of sounds fair and reasonable, it's shifting from a system which errs on the side of caution to one which doesn't, to one which is looking for a way to make cuts. And I'd rather have some people who might not need the service that much being supported rather than
rather over-servicing than under-servicing.
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, so that's a bit a bit crap if you ask me. So, yeah, as I say, this shifts a system that may err on the side of caution to one that may not identify many eligible participants. It may also require more expense to assess, shifting funding from clients to service providers. As we have seen, conservative governments tend to be mean-spirited with welfare recipients and use these criteria to raise eligibility hurdles. So you might have a Labor government that might be a little more sympathetic to this sort of thing. Labor governments don't last forever. Once you introduce these changes, you bring in a Conservative government, they'll start doing things like they did with robo-debt. They'll they'll find a way to use this process to shut it down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's don't like it, not good. There's also there are plans to divert children with mild to moderate autism and development delays away from the NDIS and into alternative state-run or foundational support programs.
The states who do not issue their own currency, Kevin.
Yeah. So what changes have been made? So the government's plan to secure the NDIS will have four pillars. I'm reading from something I found. I have to do a version for this somewhere. But it says, so they're fighting fraud and stopping rorts is what they put number one. Mm. But there's no detail on that. Like okay, so clean it up. That's good. I mean, you'd be able to redirect that money towards services, which would be terrific. But most of these cuts go towards services. So it says slowing rapid cost increases, clearer eligibility requirements, delivering quality services and support to participants. I'm calling bullshit on that. It's
another word here, Kevin. I heard you saying earlier in the week that you thought this was an austerity budget. Is this one of the reasons you were saying that?
Well, yeah, and we're going to go into this because I read an analysis by Bill Mitchell on his blog about the budget and what the
MMT economist Bill Mitchell.
Yeah, and what these numbers mean in terms of what's actually happening. And he wasn't making any ideological assessment. He was just saying, here's the numbers, and we'll get to this later on.
Okay, all right.
So
I'll hold my horses.
So what we've got here is we've got $38 billion worth of cuts, but we've got $2 billion for a thriving kids program, and this is to look after the mild to medium autism with kids. So they're just offloading that and they're going to chuck $2 billion at it. Mm-hmm. There's $5 billion for foundational supports, which is kind of like a transitional services they're going to provide when they're going from one to the other. So we were talking before about, you know, a lot of people are going to be stranded. A lot of these supports aren't set up. And so they want to be really careful about how they do this because if they just abandon people, say, right, you no longer reach the criteria, you're on your own. That's just cruel and harsh. That's not, that doesn't reflect who we are. You know, like this was a great initiative by the Labor government, and just because the scheme is bigger than they thought it would be, doesn't mean they have to be cruel.
Right, right. And the bigger thing is, as we know, as you said earlier, it's not the money that's the issue. We can spend as much as we want on this. It's the resources. Do we have enough carers like your brother?
Yeah.
to do the job? And if we don't, then we've got a problem.
Yeah. And look, obviously there's a need for this. We're talking about 300,000 people who are going to be excluded from this scheme who would otherwise be in it. So there's obviously a demand. Mm. There are people. We have unemployment. We've got unemployment sitting at 4.5%. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, and we're talking about, that's hard unemployment, but then we're talking about underemployment, which is people have got spare time on their hands. That you push that up towards about 10 to 12% when you're talking.
So we do have the resources.
We've got the clients. We've got the resources.
We should use the money, because what does money do? It puts needs together with resources.
Yeah, and macroeconomically, what's this going to do? So a whole bunch of carers are now going to be employed as opposed to being unemployed. Mm. They're going to be paid something. At a working level, when you pay people at a working level, they spend on needs. They don't stack up their investment portfolio, go and buy an investment property or shares. This goes into the economy. It stimulates business. Business is under the hammer at the moment because of rising oil prices and the inflationary effects of that. Mm. This would be a really good thing to do. Mm. The reason we're not doing it is because the government believes in the deficit myth, and this is the harm that these ideologies cause. You know,
yes. It's one of the most harmful ideas I think that humanity has come up with.
Like this is what's her name, Bullock from the RBA. Michelle Bullock was warning the government not to have an expansionary
budget. She was telling the government not to spend, in other words. She was telling the government that we want more people to be in poverty and we want more people to suffer because we have this crazy idea that has been disproven just about that we can manage inflation by putting people into poverty.
Yeah. It's insane. So at the very time that people are struggling because oil prices have gone up, so people with mortgages are under a lot of pressure because filling up the car is costing a lot of money, and the flow-on effects from that means prices in shops and stuff go up because they're all their transport costs have gone up. They're already under the hammer. So what does the RBA say? Oh, inflation's going to happen. We need to make life harder for you. And you go, how is that going to bring oil prices down? It's this insane fear that was. It's essentially a policy that's aimed straight at workers. It's saying workers are the problem here. Workers get all uppity and they want pay increases. And what we're going to do is we're going to cause a contraction by rising interest rates. We're going to shut businesses down. We're going to create larger unemployment, and that'll keep the workers under control.
Mm. Can happen, but it's not. It's very unlikely to happen, and it's not happening now.
Yeah, it's not good. Anyway, so we'll get to the Bill Mitchell analysis.
Yes.
And I read this.
The macroeconomic analysis.
I'm in quite a fortunate position at the moment, Anne. I'm doing a bit of maintenance work.
Okay.
I'm doing some maintenance work for Bill Mitchell. I'm doing some maintenance work for Victor Quirk.
it's a small world.
So I asked Bill.
As you were hammering away?
Well, I was checking out a job, and this is before he brought out his blog, and I said, can you just give me your analysis of the budget? And he went blah 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 like an economist with a huge brain and just a you know, an encyclopedic knowledge of figures, and he's quoting stuff to me and talking about this, and I'm going okay. And then I said, can I shoot you an email? And he said, just read my blog.
Right.
So I read his blog, and okay. It was kind of stuff filtering through. I'm going, right, he's talking about the current account deficit, and he started throwing in some formulas, and I'm glazing over, and I'm going, rightio, I kind of got half an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Then I caught up with Victor Quirk, and I said, Victor,
explain
have
this.
You read Bill's thing? And he goes, yeah, it's really quite simple. And I go, cool, make it simple for me.
Give us the simple version, Kev.
That's so the simple thing is this, is that the government has defined how much money they're going to spend into the economy. So there we have new money going into the economy. So that's from the government sector to the non-government sector. The non-government sector is made up of the domestic private sector
households
and the overseas sector.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill reckons we can estimate how much is going to go to the overseas sector, and we're currently running a current account deficit, which means money is flowing out of Australia and going overseas, mm-hmm. which does surprise me because I thought, like, as an export company, a country, we should be – I thought it might have been the other way around. Mm. And I really don't know much about the foreign sector.
So we're importing more than we're exporting.
Yeah, and it makes sense when you think about energy, oil, petrol, all that sort of stuff. Cars mm-hmm. are coming in. So there's a lot of things that we import, even though we're exporting a lot. And we have run – current account
surpluses
before, but we're currently running current account deficits.
Okay.
And Bill reckons you can define that. He goes, rightio, so the current account deficit is going to be this. So there's money coming into the private sector from the government spending. There's money going out of the private sector overseas. And what you're left with is an amount.
Hmm.
Now, that amount needs to cover the current requirements of the private sector. And he says when you do the maths, it's not enough. It doesn't cover the requirements of people to pay their mortgages, buy food, etc. You can sort of calculate how much our nation spends in the private sector. Right. Well, it the figures are there. And he goes,
national accounting.
Yep, national accounting. So he goes, money in through government spending, money out with the current account deficit. The private sector is left with this amount of money. If we're to maintain that standard of living, the private sector is going to have to borrow. So you could say it's a
use their credit cards.
Yep. So
take out loans.
It's okay. It's a contractionary budget.
It's an austerity budget.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm going to read what he said because it's sort of.
And what we know about when households go into debt is that it makes the economy more fragile, and so you're more likely to end up with a recession if you're not careful.
Yeah. So I'm just going to read from my notes because this is good. It says, right here. So the fiscal balance as a percentage of GDP. Since 1970-71, the fiscal deficit has averaged around 0.9% of GDP. The deficit is forecast to remain at around 1% until 2028, and then there is a forecast to be for further contraction to about 0.7% in did I say 1929?
Hmm.
No, well, I've written here 1929, but I think I meant 2029. So what he's saying is that the current deficit is like the long-term average, and it's going to contract. So there's no huge spending going on here. What we can say is the deficits are small. They should be bigger.
Mm.
The implication is that GDP growth will not be sufficient to sustain reductions in the national unemployment rate, which has risen significantly since 2024. In that sense, the current fiscal deficit is too small, and a further contraction is taking a policy in the wrong direction. A fiscal deficit of 1% of GDP is too low given the likely increase in the external deficit and the state of household finances. In other words, fiscal policy is being shaped by the dictates of the RBA. Mm. An MMT economist, regardless of their specific policy preferences, would never see it appropriate for the central bank to be determining the direction of fiscal policy.
Never.
The government forecasts that unemployment rate will rise from 4.2% to 4.5%. Look, long and short of it, he reckons unemployment's going to go up because of the contractions. At the end, he says, in general, I am unimpressed.
An understatement.
I'll read this last paragraph here. This is, the strong fiscal support during the pandemic overwhelmed all the nonsensical deficit scaremongering and allowed the private sector to increase its overall saving and pay down debt, which was a good thing. But as the previous government withdrew its stimulus and the current government continued to pursue a contractionary fiscal position, the private domestic sector has only one option, given the trends in the external sector, if it wants to maintain consumption, resume the process of accumulating more debt.
Mm.
With a global recession threatening and higher interest rates the norm, mm. the strategy outlined in the government's fiscal statement is once again placing the economy on an unsustainable path, relying on household debt accumulation, which is a finite process. In general, I'm unimpressed.
Wow.
So there you go. So
so it is the austerity budget. It is the budget then that is, in the long term, it's beating up on the middle classes. And, of course, in the short term, it's continuing, as they always do, to beat up on the lower classes, because the lower classes are always good for a financial flogging, I reckon.
Yeah, and it just seems to me really mean-spirited for this government to pick on the disabled as a way of balancing their imaginary budget, you know.
So what's your overall assessment? Are you unimpressed as well, given the slight good news there on the housing issue?
I'm impressed by the change of direction of the government away from neoliberal policies like negative gearing and the capital gains discount. So that's good, and that's brave considering the current situation. However, I'm appalled that they would beat around those on disabilities. you know, it's a shame that they have to go to that group of people to try and meet some imaginary target. Mm. You know, for instance, if we look at the military budget is set to increase $53 billion over 10 years. So they're going to spend $5.3 billion on average over the next 10 years building up the military. Mm. At the same time, they're going to slash $10 billion a year over the next 4 years from the NDIS. And you go, what's more important, like meeting the military expectations of the USA under Trump, or looking after people in your community?
I'm wondering also, Kevin, did you happen to see in the budget a $9 billion that was called for by the unionists for a job guarantee to create a job guarantee?
Oh, wow, no.
Eliminate involuntary unemployment.
Who called for that? The unions?
Unionists for a job guarantee.
Oh, good. Oh, righty. I'd look at, you know.
But I didn't see it in the budget.
No. Well,
I mean, you've always got to look at all these policies in context with each other. But did you happen to see any mention of an increase to the rate of job seeker payments for the unemployed that would lift all those people out of poverty?
Well, I did read something that said, while we have some bravery in reversing tax benefits for those enjoying passive incomes, with the real consequences of halting inflation, property prices, so that first-time owners will be more easily able to enter the market, essentially this is an austerity budget. There is nothing in the budget for the 4 million-plus people who need the most help. The age pension, youth allowance, parenting payment, job seeker, and the disability support pension, nothing. Yep. There is nothing to increase public housing. There is nothing to address climate change.
Well, until we see a budget, Kevin, that is more in line with something that one of our buddies at the pub night is going to be talking about on June the 2nd.
Ah.
June the 2nd, online, 6 to 7 p.m. And you can go get a free ticket for that at publicmoneypublicgood.net.
Publicmoneypublicgood.net?
Yes. Marcus Champ's going to be talking about what it looks like when you centrally plan your economy to deal with all these different crises. So he's talking about inflation in the time of world war, and he's talking about the lessons we could learn from that. So I think until the federal government is listening to people like Marcus, I'm not interested in their budgets. Well, thank you for the roundup.
Well,
that was,
you know,
fantastic.
Credit where credit's due, but let's put this in perspective. Let's, you know, see what the figures line up. Hey, we're not going to the pub tonight, are we? Is that next week?
Next week.
Rightio. Look up Public Money, Public Good to see where we're going to be at the pub next week to catch up and come and say good day. Especially new faces would be very welcome.
Absolute. And coming up on 3CR Community Radio, we have Mafelda.
Excellent.
See you next time, Kev.
Bye.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. You've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
We're going to do the regression theory of money to music.
That will work. That's good. Regression theory of money. What rhymes with regression? Regression, suppression, institution. There's a world of opportunity here. This has got legs. This is going to work. You know, Bill's good on the guitar. Like, he'll be straight on. Have you ever sung before in a band?
No, you don't. You do not want to hear me sing, Kevin.
What's your next theory? Just like, do it and make people like you.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.